It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a cartoonist shares the story of his life with obsessive-compulsive disorder in graphic novel form. First, the productivity of workers in the United States has gone up since the 1970s, but pay and benefits haven't kept up. Our next guest says that's because of a long-term shift in the balance of power between workers and employers, and he says the same trends have made it harder for employees to advocate for their own safety during the COVID-19 outbreak. Josh Idelson is a labor reporter for Bloomberg News and Business Week. He wrote the piece, How the American Worker Got Fleeced, for Bloomberg News. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you spell out that divergence you talk about in your article, first of all? Productivity going up per worker in the United States, while wages and benefits not.
Sure. There's been an acrimonious divorce between workers' productivity and their pay, which used to rise largely in conjunction with each other. Since the 70s, productivity has continued going up. Workers have been creating more and more wealth, but their pay has, in comparison, been more stagnant. And that's particularly true in some of the fastest growing industries in the U.S. that we've seen real wages not budging much. And in fact, if you're a minimum wage worker, then the minimum wage you're receiving is worth a lot less than it used to be.
Concerns in COVID-19. What kind of things did you see when you looked at American workplaces?
I've talked in recent months to workers in warehouses, in tech, in farm work, in domestic work, in all sorts of industries. And Americans are expressing and noticing things that many find disturbing. And the coronavirus really has laid bare issues that didn't begin with the pandemic, but that have been turbocharged or exposed by it. So people have been noticing that we have so-called essential food workers who don't get paid sick days. We have people from warehouses to hospitals who speak up about safety issues and then get terminated. And these are things that are particularly American in the way they happen, because the U.S. is an outlier when it comes to the lack of certain guaranteed protections, like being able to miss a shift and get paid if you're sick. And also when it comes to the lack of robust protection for workers who try to band together to do something about those working conditions.
We're talking to Josh Idelson, labor reporter for Bloomberg News, about his latest piece, How the American Worker Got Fleeced. Josh, both of those trends, the pay not keeping up with productivity, about workplace conditions, you tie to a longer-term trend, even a decline in labor, in unions in the United States. Take us back to how that got eroded over the decades.
That's right. So in 1935, 85 years ago this past weekend, President Roosevelt signed into law the National Labor Relations Act, a law that commits the U.S. government not just to allow or to protect, but to promote rights like collective bargaining. It's a law that promises workers it should be up to them whether they want to act together, protests, through negotiations, to collectively change their working conditions. And it's a law that's explicitly supposed to rebalance the balance of power between workers and managers and executives. Now, what has happened is not what the law promised. The law has failed. And we see now workers who take action collectively lack robust protection from retaliation. And the unionized share of the workforce has plummeted. It has plummeted for decades. Part of the reason is that some workers were excluded from the very beginning in the sexist and racist exclusions of workers like farm workers and domestic workers. Part of the reason is that the remedy that is available to workers when the law is not followed is weak. The National Labor Relations Act only offers the legal recourse of going through an agency called the National Labor Relations Board, where companies, if they fire somebody for organizing with their coworkers, generally don't have to fear anything worse than someday, eventually, maybe years later, having to bring that person back, pay them some back pay with no liability for executives, no punitive damages, and post a notice saying that they won't do it again. Workers are also supposed to be able to take matters into their own hands by putting pressure on their employer through tactics like strikes. But a series of legislative and judicial changes have made those strikes very risky and less effective. In fact, soon after the National Labor Relations Act became law, just a few years later, we saw the first of a series of very consequential rulings saying that even though the law restricts companies from firing people in retaliation for striking, it doesn't stop companies from so-called permanent replacement of strikers. And if you're the one who just lost your job, whether it was a firing or a permanent replacement is not a distinction that's going to give you a lot of comfort.
You also write about something, a big business called Labor Relations Consulting. Can you talk about what is involved in that?
Yes, we have revealed in this story what federal filings from the past couple decades show about companies from Pepsi to PetSmart. Almost any big company you can think of seems to be on the list of clients of labor relations consultants. These are companies that are brought in to try to persuade workers against unionizing or keep tabs on workers during disputes. And it's become a mammoth industry. Companies take full advantage of the opportunities the law gives them to deter workers from organizing. That can include legally holding mandatory meetings that workers have to attend, in which they can be told all kinds of ominous so-called predictions about the bad things that could happen if they unionize. Companies also, if they violate the law, for example, by firing or threatening people for organizing, don't have to fear the kinds of penalties that they might under other areas of law other than labor relations. And we've seen companies sprout up as these consultants to help companies take full advantage of each of these gaps, each of these opportunities that courts and legislators have created for companies to use the coercive power of being the boss to stop people from taking collective action.
Another angle you cover in your piece is OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, when it comes to handling complaints about worker safety, particularly in this era of COVID. It sounds like they're kind of overwhelmed now.
There has been a surge of complaints made to OSHA and its state equivalents, over 20,000 complaints. Workers have spoken up about things like allegations of healthcare establishments that are not just failing to provide, but actually restricting workers from using protective equipment. And OSHA has so far announced only one citation against a company related to the coronavirus. OSHA said in April it would generally ask companies to investigate themselves rather than sending in inspectors. And so workers have felt tremendous concern and disappointment in many cases with the lack of more forceful action, which people blame in part on the lack of resources of the agency, which entered this year with the fewest inspectors it's had in decades.
We're talking to Josh Idelson, reporter covering labor for Bloomberg News and Business Week. We're talking about his story, How the American Worker Got Fleeced. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the decline of union power has hurt American workers, or do you think it's a good trend? Has your workplace done enough to protect against the spread of COVID-19? Would you feel safe raising concerns about safety among your coworkers or even your bosses? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. I'm a producer here on Central Time. My job is to find the people and the issues around Wisconsin that matter most to you. And honestly, the best way to do that is to ask you directly. So what stories do you want to hear on our show? What people are making a difference in your community? And what concerns do you have in the state or in your county? Tell us the questions you have that no one else is answering. You can send us an email, that's centraltime@wpr.org, or tweet us at centraltimewpr. We want to hear your ideas and thanks.
There are many things to enjoy in Wisconsin in every season of the year. Wisconsin Public Radio is here 365 days a year to serve you with informative, thought-provoking programs. Thank you to WPR members whose support makes it all possible.
If you're a sustaining member, your reliable monthly donations help keep our focus on programming and less on fundraising. If you're not a sustainer yet, visit WPR.org and become one right now. Your secure, ongoing gift of $5 or $10 a month will feel great, and it'll keep Wisconsin Public Radio strong for you and your community.
Stay connected with the WPR app on Google Play and the iTunes App Store. It makes it easy to listen to WPR live and read recent news stories. You can also hear WPR programs on demand. WPR is everywhere.
Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. I apologize. Looks like we had some connection problems with our audio. We are back, I believe. Josh Idelson with us from Bloomberg News. He wrote the piece, How the American Worker Got Fleeced, for Bloomberg News. Josh, before the break and the little extra intermission there, you were starting to talk about pushback, I think, efforts to turn the pendulum in the other direction on behalf of labor. What kind of things are you seeing?
So there have been efforts for as long as workers have been trying to organize, companies have been trying to stop them through everything from industrial spies to violent police repression to mass firings. And as long as labor has been on the decline, workers have been trying to find ways to turn it around. And some of the things we've seen in recent years that have made headway include strikes by teachers who tied their cause to the cause of their community and defied mayors, governors, in some cases their own union leaders, and ended up extracting significant gains. We've seen so-called comprehensive campaigns where, rather than going through the labor board, unions have brought a combination of workplace activism, strikes, political, media, legislative, even zoning pressure, attacks on a brand to eventually squeeze a company until it agrees to a process where workers can unionize. We've seen pressure on states and cities to do things they can to boost both labor standards and some workers' ability to organize, though the federal labor law itself restricts how much they can do that. And during the pandemic, we've seen waves of strikes and walkouts by workers that have served to put a harsh public spotlight on the end of the bargain that these so-called essential workers are getting as they take on risk to keep certain services going. We've seen places from warehouses to tech to meatpacking to healthcare become sites of protests that have drawn attention. And we've also seen new precedents created during the pandemic, like the very limited conditional form of sick leave offered by Congress, or conditional protections for workers to be whistleblowers in certain cities that are being proposed, that raise questions about why broader protections are not part of the fabric of what it means to go to work in the United States.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in Menominee. Kevin, hello.
Hi, can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
Okay.
Yeah, Kevin, you're on the air. What did you want to bring up?
Okay, I was fired in early May, and I'm pretty sure it was because I pointed out deficiencies in the company's token COVID-19 actions. And I would urge anyone who is in this similar situation to use caution and record everything that you do on your phone if you have a conversation with someone about this kind of stuff. For myself, I haven't gotten any unemployment compensation. And of course, there's a big backlog there. So anyway, that's all I have.
Kevin, thanks a lot for that call. Josh, what do you think of what Kevin had to say?
This is the kind of disturbing allegation that we're hearing from workers all over the country. And a part of what it reflects is what it's like to work under so-called at-will employment in the United States, where the presumption is a company doesn't need any good reason to fire you. They can fire you for almost any reason. And if you're fired for one of the few reasons that's illegal, such as for taking collective action with your coworkers around work conditions, then it can be very difficult to prove that that's what's happened. And that fear of retaliation silences people individually and collectively. And workers who I've talked to in all sorts of industries that some people think are radically alien to each other, have expressed similar concerns that decisions get made without full input, let alone veto, from the workers that will be most affected. And workers are constrained in their ability to address it because they worry about losing their jobs. And these are stories that I'm always interested in hearing about, whatever kind of work you're doing. And so please, anyone, reach out to me.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kevin. Dan joins us now in Dane County. Dan, hello.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I heard a topic about COVID-19 and the pandemic and how it's affected workers all across the country. And I'm a truck driver myself, and I deliver freight all across the Midwest and all across the country sometimes. And what I've noticed from a lot of the warehouses that was mentioned before and the workers within, but I'm sort of a kind of a tangent to those businesses because I go there maybe once or twice a week, and some places I'll only be there one time and I won't be there again. Now, my concern with these places is, since the pandemic and since the lockdowns, they have restricted access for us truck drivers into their facility. So they want minimum contact with us. Now, what that entails is oftentimes they won't allow us to use their facilities, to use their restrooms, to wash our hands, to use a sink with water and soap to actually wash our hands. So what they do oftentimes is they might replace our access to the restrooms with porta potties. And these porta potties won't have any water or soap that we can wash our hands with after we use it. They're usually completely filthy because there's one porta potty, and all of the truck drivers who go there throughout the weeks or the months that this has been going on have been using the same one, and it's absolutely unsanitary and unusable sometimes. And they'll put a hand sanitizer there as a replacement for a sink and soap, which is not a good replacement. A hand sanitizer does not do the same job as washing your hands with soap and water. And a lot of times, even those hand sanitizer dispensers will be empty. So we're essential workers. Those businesses, those warehouses depend on us to bring them the material they need for them to conduct their business. But as the people who bring them that valuable service, we're expected to, we're basically ignored and expected to fend for ourselves when it comes to these essential needs. So I'm not sure what exactly Dan's feeling about that.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. I hadn't even thought about that from the perspective of truck drivers, Josh. In our last couple of minutes, what do you think?
I think this is the kind of issue that a lot of workers in different industries are voicing. And part of what Dan's experience reflects is many workers in the U.S. are creating wealth for and being subject to rules from a company that on paper doesn't employ them. This so-called fissured workplace in which the employer-employee relationship that our New Deal laws are based around is not the situation that workers have found themselves shoved into. And so that's something that further frays the lines of accountability in workers trying to seize a measure of dignity and compensation on the job. And this is a trend that has been going on for a long time, including in laws like Taft-Hartley that took more workers and pushed them out of the bounds of labor law protection.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Josh, thanks for bearing with the technical troubles there. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. And please, anyone reach out, JEIDELSON@Bloomberg.net.
Josh Idelson is a labor reporter for Bloomberg News and Business Week covering the American workplace. We've got his piece, How the American Worker Got Fleeced, up at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, the author of a new graphic novel shares the story of his life with OCD. We'll meet the author of Everything Is an Emergency. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Manhattan prosecutors can subpoena President Trump's tax returns, according to a decision made by the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll learn more about that case and a congressional suit that was kicked back to lower courts. First, we sometimes see portrayals in pop culture of people with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. But in the real world, what's it like to live with OCD from day to day? Jason Adam Katzenstein has used his artistic abilities to answer that question about his experience with OCD. Jason is a cartoonist and writer. He's done work for The New Yorker, New York Times, Mad Magazine, and Cartoon Network. His new book is called Everything Is an Emergency, an OCD Story in Words and Pictures. Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, Jason, as a cartoonist, you're generally trying to make yourself and your readers laugh. What led you into wanting to draw and write about your own experience with OCD?
Well, there's also definitely a rich tradition of memoir and autobiographical stories and comics. But for me, OCD, I think, is pretty consistent with wanting to make people laugh or just drawing work that is kind of outlandish because it feels like a cartoon to me.
And I thought going into this, really a comic about OCD, but then reading it, I thought, yes, a comic about OCD, because you're able to visualize so many of your experiences as a child and then as a grown up. It actually seems like kind of a natural when you're actually reading it.
Oh, I'm so glad that you felt that way, because I talked to a lot of friends with OCD about how it's very strange to try and convey to other people what's happening because they're not seeing it. A lot of this really is going on in our brains. And so I wanted to draw visually the way that it felt.
Can you talk a little bit about life as a kid with OCD, especially before you even, you know, maybe even heard that phrase or got that diagnosis? What was that experience like for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I felt insane, really, because I knew that there were these things that were these thoughts that were, rolling around in my brain, and I was performing these actions, and I knew even at the time that they were not rational and they were not what other kids were doing. But I also didn't know how to stop doing them. And so I think before I got the diagnosis, there was, on top of the obsessions and the compulsions, this like, I'm so weird, I'm so crazy. If anybody knew what I was secretly doing, they would make fun of me all the time.
And early on, you sought solace and I think expression through art. What led you into that, which of course became your career?
I've just always naturally loved to draw. It's something, I think that the thing also that is pretty coherent with some of these thoughts and also drawing is that it's a way to exert control over my world.
You had an experience that I've heard also sometimes from people who have had depression or bipolar disorder, this concern if they seek treatment, especially if they seek medical treatment, they ask themselves, am I going to lose my creativity? Is this condition the thing that leads to my art? Can you talk about how you thought through that over the years?
Yeah, I think that it's a myth that we see again and again in our stories, in movies, on television, in books. And I part of me knew, okay, maybe this is just a myth, and another part suspected, well, maybe this is true and maybe I need to be miserable to make work, or I just wasn't used to feeling any other way. And so if the creativity was happening when I was feeling this way, what would happen when some of the symptoms were removed? But I do look at the book as kind of a rebuttal to that notion, because this is a book that I made after I really tended to some of this stuff, and I was feeling great, and I was feeling very creative.
And not only that, and other people have told me roughly the same thing, once you started to get a handle on OCD, you re-fell in love with creating art.
Yeah, and I hadn't even realized that I'd forgotten what it felt like to really love it.
We are talking about a life with obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. Jason Adam Katzenstein is with us. His new book, it's a comic, a graphic novel. It's called Everything Is an Emergency, an OCD Story in Words and Pictures. Can you talk about how OCD affected your relations with other people over the years, with, you know, when you went out into the world and were making friends?
Well, I think that to be close to somebody with OCD is to watch them deal with a lot of pain, and it's hard to know how to help exactly. I the friends in my life, my family, sometimes they want to perform my compulsions for me, like open doors, right? Wash things, keep me away from the world and the things that really scare me. And it's an impulse that I really understand, but it's also one that legitimizes the initial obsessions. So just like when I do those things, when I wash my hands over and over, it makes it feel like the thing that I'm afraid of, I should be afraid of. That's also true when the people who love me and care about me do that stuff. And so for me, it's been a process of trying to get better at asking for what I actually need, which is not for people to make me feel more comfortable in the moment, but for them to support me. So together, you know, we can get over whatever the obsessive thought is. But it must also be quite frustrating. I mean, I don't even want to conjecture here. It is frustrating. Like I've talked to friends about it. And, you know, if you watch somebody step on the same rake over and over, that's frustrating.
Something that surprised me, you write and talk about your experience in group sessions with other people with obsessive compulsive disorder. And do I have this right? You kind of made fun of each other's compulsions. That was kind of part of the treatment?
Yeah. That was something that I was surprised about going in. but it actually, I mean, it made a lot of sense to me as somebody who does comedy, because one thing that you do with jokes is you take the winds out of the sails of power. And so things that feel like these threats can be made into things that are ridiculous. And that's a tool that you use in satire all the time. So it was a way to kind of satirize our OCD and take some of the power away.
You also draw your renditions of some of the experiences you had with OCD. You have characters called contamination, guilt, panic, relationships, and also OCD itself is kind of a character. Is that part of how you have learned to deal with it, by treating it as a separate character in your life?
Yeah, there's a lot of OCD therapy. There's this refrain, it's not me, it's my OCD. There's, I mean, one thing that can be really distressing about having OCD is feeling like, well, am I somebody who really wants this? Or am I somebody who's really like this? And so there is a bit of separating work that you need to learn to do between yourself and this part of you. And so comics are a great medium for personifying that separation. So it's like me in a weird costume, or it's like, you know, the monstrous distorted version of the thing.
I want to talk about the treatment that you went through a little bit. And part of it was working with this group and kind of making fun of each other's compulsions. Part of it was seeing the OCD as a separate character, but also confronting the compulsions and the fears of contamination. You had literally one of the treatments was to touch your shoe and then to touch your face. And that sounds like it was really hard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was really hard. So that's called exposure and response prevention therapy. And what you do is you summon the things that are distressing to you. And so I've had a lot of contamination obsessions over the years. And what you do is you make a hierarchy. And so that was a pretty low level exposure because it's something that felt icky, but it also felt like something I could do. Whereas higher level exposures would revolve around things like public restrooms. And so you don't just do it. You do it and then you refrain from doing the thing that your brain says is the thing that's going to save you. So you touch your shoe, you touch your face, and you don't wash. And that feels distressing, but you do it over and over again. And when you do that and you teach yourself that the distress is a little bit out of whack with the actual thing that you're doing, it's like you're learning to rehabituate yourself to the situation. And you're teaching your brain that things that feel like really five alarm fire emergencies are not.
You took a long time to work through this and get where you are now, where you're able to write and draw and talk about this. If there's somebody out there listening who has OCD to whatever degree and isn't there or isn't there yet, what would you say to them?
I would say you're not alone. And that's the reason that I made the book too. The community that I've found in group therapy and also friendships, just talking to people about this has been really, really important to me. And no matter where you are in your recovery process, you're not alone. And knowing that there are people out there who will hold me accountable to my ERP therapy, and knowing that there are people out there who are cheering me on has been essential to my own recovery. And I hope that if you do read this book and there are things in it that you recognize, that you know that there are other people out there who are going to cheer you on too.
It's a good place to leave it. Jason, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jason Adam Katzenstein is a cartoonist and writer for The New Yorker and elsewhere. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called Everything is an Emergency, an OCD Story in Words and Pictures. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on two cases involving access to President Trump's tax returns. We'll learn more about those decisions and what they can mean for the president coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, hundreds of companies are suspending their advertising on Facebook over its handling of misinformation and hate speech. We'll find out what this means for the site and its users. First, in a 7-2 decision today, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Manhattan prosecutors could subpoena 8 years of President Trump's tax returns. In a separate decision, the justices also decided to shield the documents from a congressional inquiry, sending that case to a lower court. President Trump has long pushed back against making his tax returns public in a break from presidential precedent. Today, he tweeted that the decision means he'll have to, quote, keep fighting in a politically corrupt New York, end quote. And he said the move was unfair towards him and his administration. David Farenthold is a reporter for The Washington Post and covers the Trump family and its business interests. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you.
Well, David, people may have seen headlines this morning and thought, okay, those Trump tax returns are on their way. We're going to see them pretty soon. Probably not, right?
No, not so much. I mean, the legal dimension, this ruling was a loss for Trump because he had asserted this ability to be immune from any state level investigation. But politically, it still serves his purposes in that I don't think anybody in the general public is going to see Trump's tax returns until after the 2020 election, and maybe not until long after the 2020 election.
Well, let's take us into this this Manhattan prosecutor and what they're trying to get from the president here and why. Just take us to the origins of this case, please.
Well, it goes back to the story of Stormy Daniels. Probably everybody remembers this adult film actress who was paid off right before the 2016 election so she wouldn't tell her story of an alleged affair with Trump. The Michael Cohen, who was Trump's lawyer at the time, paid Daniels, and then Cohen got paid back by the Trump Organization, Trump's business. And so what Cy Vance, the Manhattan District Attorney, is doing is looking to see whether any laws were broken in that payoff, that reimbursement. Did they hide anything, commit any sort of fraud in the way that they paid Cohen back and then accounted for that payment?
They can subpoena it now. That doesn't mean it's in their hands now, right? There would still be a process for that prosecutor to get hold of those tax returns. What would that look like?
Well, the Supreme Court's decision basically said that Trump was wrong to assert that he has a special immunity against subpoenas because he is president. But it said, but he still has the same power against subpoenas that you or I would have, which is you can say the subpoena is overbroad, the subpoena is burdensome. You know, there's some reason why the court shouldn't grant this sort of subpoena to a regular person. And so now what will happen is Trump will go back to New York and say and make those kinds of arguments. Look, you know, this subpoena is wrong for this or that reason. And there like will be some sort of delay as the court considers it. Whatever they rule could be appealed. You know, even if the court moves fast for a court, that could be weeks or months.
That's one of the two cases about the president's tax returns. Then we have Congress saying, hey, we want access to financial records from the president. What did the Supreme Court end up saying about their request now?
Basically, the Supreme Court said that Congress can ask for things like this, for financial records from presidents, but that in this specific case, Congress had overstepped its authority and asked for too much. It had asked for not just Trump's tax returns, but all records of financial transactions for the last several years, including Trump and his children and maybe even his grandchildren. So the Supreme Court said, okay, that also has to go back to a lower court, and you, Congress, have to shrink your request until it can meet this sort of four-part test that the Supreme Court laid out describing when a Congress can ask for a president's financial records. Again, we're talking about a pretty long delay.
Right. The argument from the president's lawyers here was, in effect, this is a fishing expedition. There's no specific need for this information, this wide variety of information that Congress is asking for. Does that kind of sum up their case here?
That's right. Congress really got itself in trouble because the Supreme Court never likes to have people come before it and say, hey, our power is unlimited. There's no limit on our power. And that was effectively Congress's argument to the Supreme Court. When they went before them a couple of months ago, the Supreme Court said, hey, you know, you want all this information from the president. Is there anything you could ask for that would be too much? You know, do you recognize any limits on your ability to seek the president's financial documents? And the House was basically like, no, we can look at anything, any issue we might possibly legislate on in the future. And that seemed to be way too much for the court, so they pushed back.
We're talking to David Farenthold, reporter for The Washington Post, looking at two U.S. Supreme Court decisions on the president's tax returns. Long story short, they might come out to a prosecutor in Manhattan. Not going to happen soon. The public, good chance we won't see it until Election Day, possibly well after that. David, let's look at this wider saga of how Donald Trump's tax returns before he was President Trump became this this Maltese Falcon in some ways that everybody wants to get their hands on, but nobody can quite manage to do that.
That's right. And just to explain, this is not something that we're doing just because, you know, we want to get Donald Trump. Donald Trump has done this unprecedented thing where he's taken his business into the White House with him and all the connections and loans and business arrangements that comes with that. And so the president has a set of private relationships with banks, with investors, with customers that he knows about and they know about, but we, the public, don't know about. That's why it's important to try to get his tax returns and other financial documents. Is I want to understand how President Trump sees the world and what he sees as his connections, because I only know half the picture now, or less than half the picture. So that's why people have been interested in getting them. And Trump has been saying since he ran for president, oh, I want to release them, but I can't for various reasons. Most often, my returns are under audit, which is a assertion he's never proven. So he's made that excuse for a long time and still seems to be making it today.
There's no legal requirement that a presidential candidate running for office has to release these tax returns. General precedent is they do, right?
That's right. One of the things that Trump has always been good at is using honor systems, sort of exploiting honor systems. He finds some place where everybody else does one thing, not because they have to, but because everybody else does it. And then he doesn't do that thing and and takes advantage of the advantage that gives him. And so this is just one example of that. Every other presidential candidate had released their tax returns, some of them probably grudgingly because they thought, well, I've got to. People expect it. Trump just didn't do it and said, well, you know, come after me, make me do it. And nobody's been able to do it so far.
In the past, when we've talked to you back during the campaign, actually, David, you were looking at the Trump Foundation and how it used its resources in creative ways, ways that it wasn't supposed to, it turned out. Are there particular questions that you are waiting to have answered that you think could be answered by looking at these tax return records?
Oh, sure. I mean, we might know his true revenue of his business, his true debt. You know, how much gain or loss he counts every year. You might know something about who he owes money to or who pays money to him. And you might also just know whether he complies with tax laws. I mean, you have to remember that the Trump Foundation's taxes we could see because it was a nonprofit. And so that's done by the same tax firm. It's, you know, on information provided by Trump's business. And there were huge amounts of errors in there. Some of them, it actually got the Trump Foundation sued by the New York Attorney General. So we've seen the work of these people before in the tax returns of the Trump Foundation and found some pretty major errors in it, which makes us think maybe there's, you know, the same people might have produced similar mistakes in the Trump organization or Trump's personal taxes.
You mentioned Donald Trump's former personal attorney back before he was president, Michael Cohen. He testified before Congress that I believe is the Trump organization had reported real estate values differently if they were talking to a tax assessor versus an insurance company versus a mortgage agent. This came out in a New York Times report. Apparently, it'll be part of Mary Trump, his niece's book. Is that something that these kind of tax records could confirm, that different values were reported to different parties of interest?
Well, that's the kind of thing that the House was asking for, particularly. They had asked Deutsche Bank, you know, when Trump came to you to get loans, because a lot of Trump's loans in recent years came from Deutsche Bank, you know, what did Trump tell you about his ability to pay, about his assets? You know, did he inflate the value of his assets and fool you? And that's the kind of document that the House is now not going to get, at least not for a long time, because of the Supreme Court's ruling.
So what kind of things are you watching for next? Are there other avenues out there where people are trying to get either this particular information or comparable information via different sources?
These two are the most advanced. So it was going to happen before the election. I think it was going to happen through one of these vehicles. One of the really interesting things to me was the Democrats that took over the House in the 2018 elections actually moved really slowly to challenge Trump on questions about his personal finances. They seemed to proceed as if Donald Trump was not Donald Trump and that he would just comply with a nice letter. And we've seen that in so many different areas involving his tax returns, his hotels, his loans. They gave Trump a long time to respond. And when he didn't respond, then they went to court. But it was far too late to get any sort of answers out of the court system before the 2020 election. So there are a bunch of other efforts going on like this, but none of them are as advanced as these. And I don't see any of them getting to this point before 2020 election.
And we've seen hints over time, some records from the 80s, I think, were in that Mary Trump leak to the New York Times. One or two pages of the president's taxes had come up somewhere along the way. Do you think there's a likelihood, if it hasn't happened yet, of other leaks of that nature? Just in our last 30 seconds or so, David.
Well, you never know. If anybody has them, I'd love to see them. And I know they're out there, but I can't predict they'll come out if they haven't come out yet.
David, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you.
David Farenthold is a reporter for The Washington Post. He covers the Trump family and its business interests. He joins today to talk about a couple of U.S. Supreme Court decisions on efforts to get a look at President Trump's tax returns, both 7-2 decisions. One ultimately sent it back to a Manhattan prosecutor to subpoena. It will allow a subpoena of those documents. It won't allow presidential immunity to stop that. But as we heard, that doesn't mean they would come out ever or anytime soon between now and Election Day. Also, a congressional effort to look at President Trump's financial records of various sorts sent back to a lower court. Developments on those could follow, could be months, if not years, before any of those, as we just heard, go through. The other day, we re-aired a conversation about the joys of swimming and why humans like to be in or even near water so much. Our guest told us about some of the research about why water is good for our sense of calm and well-being, whether we're actually out swimming in it or just sitting by it or in it. Well, I put that to the test today. Checking out our responses on Twitter, at Central Time WPR, I saw a listener who goes by the handle Daxian had sent us a note along with a video. He wrote, "Luckily, I live near Devil's Lake. I've been snorkeling there a lot this summer. Here's some video." The video was a snorkeler's eye view of Devil's Lake, just kind of swimming around, following fish, that kind of thing. Just a little over a minute or so. But here's the thing. I checked it out in the middle of my workday today, and you know what? All of a sudden, just watching the water and the fish, I felt way more calm than I had beforehand. Not that I was, you know, uncalm, but I was more calm. Now, this tells me two things. One, this calming effect of water, scientifically proven, it's real, if it even works, just seeing it in a YouTube video. And two, send me more water videos or pictures. Your local stream, river, or lake, a pool or a pond. Pond's good for me. There don't need to be people in it, just some water. Give us your water photos or video links. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. If I trail off mid-sentence on the show over the next week, maybe it's because I'm so relaxed from watching your video. It's water news I can use. This is Central Time.